Hello, this is Richard Allibone again on webtalkradio.net. This week is about something very much paranormal, but apparently is something more than mind to mind. It's about interaction between mind and the physical world, and it's called remote viewing. My guest is Gwyn Hocking, whose background is in chemistry, and he became Professor of Materials Chemistry at the University of London in 2001, and has also been interested for a long time in paranormal events. His study of remote viewing, or seeing at a distance, will show us how the ancient Egyptians used to protect their borders against intruders, and how in modern times remote viewing has been taught and studied at Stanford University. Not only is this about the flow of information from the physical world to mind, for example, being able to see into a closed envelope or box, but the same process allows the mind to affect things in the physical world, like bending a spoon, which is also called remote viewing. Gwyn goes into the details of the ways that deep trance may be achieved by discussing many different techniques. Let's meet my guest, Professor Gwyn Hocking. Hello, Gwyn.
Hello.
Hello, it's nice for you to come on my show today, talking about remote viewing. Now, I have to say, I'm a little bit confused as to what extent remote viewing is tied up with things like telepathy and out-of-the-body experiences and things. Now, perhaps you could tell us a bit about that.
Yes, it's not new. It has been used by the CIA recently, and there's about 40 or 50 books in Amazon on remote viewing, if one looks that up as a topic. It was used by the ancient Egyptians about 5,000 years ago. Temples had specially trained girls who were able to remote view, and you'll notice that the statues of most of the pharaohs have got a little snake-like protuberance on the forehead, the so-called third eye, which is said to be one of the chakras that exists. And by extending that to anywhere in the planet, you can view remotely what's going on there. The ancient Egyptians were said to use it for finding out if anyone was about to attack their borders. Now, it can be improved or enhanced in a person who doesn't have it by various methods, such as meditation, breath control. There's an inner energy called Kundalini residing at the base of the spine, which is activated by an increased CO2 level in the body, and this is achieved by holding the breath. It's dangerous if it's overdone. One has to be careful here. One can compare this with CO2 narcosis in submarines. It's a narcotic effect produced by high CO2 levels. And the effect of this, it causes Kundalini to rise up the spine. And when it reaches a high level in between the eyes, the so-called third eye, with the snake of the pharaohs, it activates the so-called third eye and causes remote viewing. Now, I've said that very quickly. Of course, it takes a long time or an innate gift to reach that state. The CIA some years ago set up a group called the Remote Viewing Group, and many people were naturally able to do this. Sometimes it can happen spontaneously, sometimes by some accident. One of the reviewers there was in a war situation, and a bullet hit his helmet with a rather high force, and after that, when he woke up uninjured, he found that he could remote view, and he was recruited into the CIA's group for remote viewing. Mm-hmm. Another person is Ingo Swann. This appears on a video of the CIA activities, which will be available on my... The reference to it will be available on my website, which is www.4-d.org.uk. The reference to this CIA activity will be on there. It's a free video available on the internet.
Yeah.
Ingo Swann was one of the main viewers. And when he came to London about 25 years ago, before he joined the CIA group, he was able to read random numbers from a random number generator and got them absolutely correct every time. He's a gifted person. He reminds me a bit of Chan Canasta. Now, he was in the 1960s and did a number of programs for the BBC in which he did things. I'll just briefly say what they were. I'll put the YouTube references on my website. There's a few YouTube videos of him. And what he would do is to ask, or he would get some random numbers, which were to be the position of the shelf stack, the position of the number of the shelf from, measured from the bottom or the top, the number of the position of the book on the shelf. These were all random numbers. So, and then the page number was also randomly selected, and then the line number was randomly selected. And then the BBC had a person in the library, which is 10 miles away, and Chan Canasta would, before anything was done, he would read that those words on that line. Then the person would go to the shelf, select all those random numbers and find the book and take the book off the shelf, and he was correct every time. Unfortunately, that was before the days of video, so that there are no videos of that. But just before he retired, he did have a video session with Michael Parkinson, and that's the one that's on the YouTube available to have a look at.
That's right.
Again, he only did about five minutes of that particular demonstration, which was his most spectacular one, but it is well worth seeing.
Yes, I watched some of that, yeah. It's something which has been going on for a long time, and you say there is an awful lot of information about it.
Yes, yes. The CIA group has now gone underground, so one can't get any more information. They have a freedom of information policy in America, and that's why so much came out about 10 years ago now, and that video was made that I just mentioned to you. I'm sure other countries do this, but they don't publicise it.
Yes, that's right. And the object of the exercise, well, the object of the CIA work was to enable spying of some sort, I presume.
Yes, one of the most remarkable people was Joseph McMoneagle, who on TV here some 10 years ago described what he did, and he said that he was able to project his consciousness to anywhere in the world. He went to China and was able to look inside the nuclear missiles and see the trigger mechanisms, and that was one of the activities he did. He got a congressional medal for his activities.
I always tend to regard these things as an extension to telepathy, but of course telepathy is only mind to mind, and it doesn't involve sort of looking at numbers and random number generator or looking into a mechanism or looking at perhaps a name or a word written on a piece of paper in an envelope. This is one of the
classic systems.
Mm-hmm. And some of these people seem to be able to do that, which is quite fascinating.
Sorry, one of the most remarkable ones was Uri Geller in his famous experiment at Stanford, which is written up in Nature in 1975. And he did a very simple experiment. There was a steel box in laboratory conditions at Stanford Research Institute. And inside this box was a dice. The dice was put in the box. The box was sealed up, all steel, shaken. And then he was simply asked to read the dice. And he got that right 9 times out of 10. The 10th one, he just said pass. And the chance of that was 1 in a million. That was in lab conditions, and there was absolutely no fraud possible for that experiment. Now, skeptics tend to just ignore that. What they can't explain, they just simply ignore as if it hadn't ever happened. But fortunately, that particular one was written up in Nature, which is a very prestigious scientific journal.
I have to say, I've never heard of that one. I have watched Uri Geller doing his sort of show, some of which is, to say the least of it, questionable. But on the other hand, he did a pretty good demonstration of telepathy, anyway, with the audience. I'll have to have a look at that dice experiment at Stanford. That's a very good one, isn't it? Yeah. Now, going on to the state of mind, which helps to bring on this remote viewing, meditation and breath control. Breath control presumably just means very slow winding down.
Well, holding the breath after you've breathed in and holding the breath again after you've breathed out. But there are cautions. People who overdo it can become mentally unstable, and one has to be careful. One should read books on yoga and just note the cautions before embarking on that if you're not used to doing that. One of the main problems with meditation is that you know that you're sitting on a chair or on the floor. Now, one big advantage, if one could remove that sense of touch, is to use something like a flotation tank. If you float in water at skin temperature, which is about 35.5 degrees C, in a totally black room, all sensation of the body disappears. You don't know that you've got arms and legs because you're floating in the water. It's isostatic, so the pressure is everywhere the same. There's no sensation you're lying on anything. It's pitch black. You don't even know whether you're the right way up or not. If one can relax, it's not easy at first. You have to relax. It may take several sessions. Then you can get into a mental state which is very unusual indeed, because it causes the brain to turn up the gain. When I say that, I mean the brain is all the time looking for input. It expects to see something or hear something. If it sees and hears nothing and feels nothing, it's a very, very unusual state. And in that state, the brain turns up the gain on all its senses. And the subliminal sixth sense begins to come to the fore. Normally, that's drowned out by all the things we look at. All our five senses will drown out the sixth sense, which we all have. But in the flotation tank, there are no other five senses. There's only the subliminal sixth sense. And so one begins to perceive things. In different people's cases, it may be one person will see a cartoon of Mickey Mouse or something. Other people remember scenes from childhood, and they're often very vivid and bright images, very unusual. Now, in that state, one can do things that one would not normally be able to do. Remote viewing is a possibility, in that one could project oneself out to a remote place. But again, it's not easy.
No. No, I know. I studied these flotation tanks a little bit, and in fact, I found one in my own town here. But I have to say, I haven't tried it. But I have spoken to people who have used them for relaxation. But if one is a little bit more determined, you can reach some altered state of consciousness. That's really what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
And the brain goes into this balanced symmetry, I believe.
Yes. It looks like a bit like a Christmas tree. If you plot the vertical axis is the frequency, and the horizontal left and right are the amplitude, imagine like a Christmas tree you're looking at, where you've got a frequency at the top end, which is the beta frequency, about 18 cycles per second or 18 hertz. That's our normal everyday waking state. And then if you close your eyes and think of nothing, most people get into what's called the alpha state after a few minutes, in which the beta state begins to reduce, and a slightly lower frequency, about 10 cycles per second, appears on the left and right. And then if you fall asleep, or rather if you go into a dream state, your frequency drops even lower, about four cycles per second or 4 hertz. Now, in the dream state, we can't bring forward anything to our waking state because we're asleep. We may remember dreams, but we can't control them. Now, it's of interest to remember Edison's example. He used to have an easy chair, and he would sit in this chair. He had a metal plate on the floor and a heavy object like an orange or something in his hand, and he'd try and drift off into a dream state. And then if he drifted off too far, he'd release the orange automatically. It would clang on the metal plate, and it would wake him up. Now, in that state, he would have a little bit of waking state, like a Christmas tree again, a little bit of waking state, a little bit of alpha state, and a little bit of theta state all together. And that Christmas tree, which is balanced left and right, is the ideal state for bringing forward the dreams into your conscious mind. And that's how he got a lot of inventions. He was able to bring forward inventions, which normally he might dream and forget about in the morning. He was able to retain the waking state and the dream state. And in science, this is ignored largely. People probably don't know about it unless they've read about it. But even if they'd read, I think they probably wouldn't want to do that. Scientists tend to reject things where they find slightly unusual. However, Einstein was able to get into the theta state, the dream state, and remain in the waking state at the same time. And And he brought forward a lot of his ideas by that means. It's a very unusual condition, and most people can't get into it.
Yes, it's the condition of healers and yogis, I believe.
Yes.
And I have heard the mention of Edison's system, sitting holding an orange. I think it's very funny, but clearly it worked. And he was one of these people who realized that working on some sort of new development problem, if he could get information from his subconscious, then this helped with this would bring forth new ideas and
so on. That's right.
Yeah. I was a development engineer, and although I didn't mess about with oranges and things, I did realize that sometimes one would get sort of inspiration from somewhere.
Sometimes they use this in advertising, for example, or any industry at all. What they have is a brainstorming session where you sit around a table and people are allowed to say and encouraged to say anything they like, anything, however crazy. They're looking at a particular problem, suggesting how it may be solved. And this activates the right side of the brain. If you start laughing and joking about, the normal left side of the brain, which is the linear logical calculator, is joined by the right side of the brain, which is the intuitive side, which artists use, music and so on. And in that state, sitting around a table and saying all kinds of crazy things, you can bring forward intuitive ideas which may originate in the right side of the brain. And then afterwards, after the meeting, they then go through in a sober way, throwing out the crazy ones. And it's often found that some ideas are produced in these meetings which are actually quite valuable. But they don't quite, I don't think they quite know what they're doing. They've heard of brainstorming, but they don't analyze it in the way that I've just done.
No, it's the light-hearted approach which tends to bring it out. Yes, I know about that. And of course, there's one thing which you'd mentioned to me when I heard you lecturing, something called Buddha's Delight, where various Chinese chemicals can help to bring on this remote viewing state.
Yes, that's quite remarkable. But quite by chance, I went to a Chinese restaurant and looking for a vegetarian dish, I noticed Buddha's Delight. I thought I'd try that. I was very surprised that evening when I was asleep. I got extremely vivid dreams, and so I looked this up on the internet. If you look at Buddha's Delight, it takes you to a recipe for it, and it contains lily buds. Now, these contain a chemical known as galantamine, a pharmacologically active chemical, galantamine. And anyone interested in this must see the book by Yuschak. I'll spell that, Yuschak. T. Yuschak, called Advanced Lucid Dreaming. It's available on Amazon. Very interesting. It's been known actually for about, well, at least 2,000 years. In fact, Pliny mentions the use of it. It's been used in Eastern Europe in folklore as a memory enhancing substance. And it's used in some of the first stage Alzheimer's treatments. It seems to be relatively harmless, and one can get these tablets available from a herbalist in California. It is used, but it's on prescription only, in first stage Alzheimer's treatments. And one of the remarkable things is that if you take this galantamine, it gives you lucid dreams, so lucid, in fact, that it looks exactly like the real world. I first heard about lucid dreams about 30 years ago at a lecture by Per Vilayat Khan of the Sufi order, and he said that when he goes to sleep, he immediately goes into a lucid dream. Lucid means that it's just like daylight consciousness. You can decide what to do in the dream. Normally, in our dreams, we're just a spectator. We can't decide anything. But in a lucid dream, you can decide to do this and that. And he said that all through the night, he can do what he wants. And then when he wakes up in the morning, he goes immediately back into ordinary consciousness. So he has 24-hour consciousness, quite a remarkable state. And he tried to tell us in this lecture he gave that this is a very good state to be in. But he didn't say too much about how you get into it. Well, galantamine will take you into that state with some reservations. The best time to take it is 4 a.m. in the morning, because you're then at a stage where you've got REM sleep, rapid eye motion sleep, and that's the best time to take it and to get into that situation. It only happened to me once without it, and that's when I came back from a conference in Hawaii. My time clock was jet lag was there, and when I was asleep, I was conscious of my bedroom, which was completely exactly like it was, just as if I was wide awake. But there were garlands of flowers on the wall. And then as I woke up, the flowers disappeared and the room was exactly as it was. So, but that's very unusual. By altering one's time clock, one can perhaps get this kind of thing without assistance.
But that
is certainly a very interesting state to be in, a lucid dream state.
But the galantamine is the magic word, really.
Yes, that's right.
One can look that up on the internet, I believe.
If you look up galantamine in Wikipedia, you'll find quite a lot about it. Sound and light machines have been known for quite a lot longer, and I would particularly recommend just the tape, the tapes which give a beat frequency. You don't need to have a sound and light machine. You can just get the tape and wear headphones, and it puts frequency into the ears, which is slightly different. And the difference frequency is used to drive the brain state. And you can start off with 18 cycles, beta state, waking state, take it down slowly to alpha state, 12 cycles, and down further to the theta state. And the famous one is called High Coherence by Kelly Hutchison. The book to look at there is called Mega Brain by M. Hutchison. Another one, famous one, is Waveform by ABR. There's another one called Total Relaxation. There's quite a lot, actually. If you look at Mega Brain, you'll probably find something on that. These are well worth trying and very powerful methods for relaxation and driving your frequencies down to towards an alpha and theta state.
Yes, I have spoken to people that make CDs and so on, and they didn't seem to know about this descending frequency, which I believe is the important bit. When I went to Max Cade, he had a descending visual system, flashing light in the room. He would subtly change that frequency from alpha down to theta, and it was this that made a lot of difference and brought on an altered state.
That's right. I actually went to his lectures as well, and I have a photo flash. One can have a photo flash and drive it electronically in the way you just said, going down from 18 down to about 4 hertz. In more recent years, these have been replaced by LEDs in goggles that you actually wear as a kind of eyepiece. It's important if you use that to shut your eyes. You must never look at these with open eyes, because the laser action of LEDs can cause harm to the eye. If you shut your eye, it's fine. And it also gives red flashes, which are ideal for this purpose.
And it's the Pauling frequency which does it.
Yeah.
But the more modern technique is to, as you say, to have a different frequency, one in one ear, one in the other ear, and the combination of those then gives you a beat in brain.
Yeah.
Which then can descend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. And it's all these things which have come along in the last 20 or 30 years, really.
Let me just put in something on that. The pharaohs in Egypt, they had a spoked wheel. What you'd do there is you'd lie horizontal, looking up, with closed eyes. The sun's above you, and there was a horizontal spoked wheel, like a bicycle wheel, but with thicker spokes. And someone would turn that wheel, and that would create flashing on your eyes in the beta frequency, which they then reduced alpha and theta. So 2,000 years ago, it was used in ancient Egypt by the pharaohs. How about that?
That's marvellous, isn't it? And is there any evidence that they deliberately reduced the frequency, do you know?
I don't know the details. I only know that they used flashing lights to affect brain states.
Yes. And obviously, if they just set this wheel going, it would gradually slow down anyways, which would... So it was really an automatic system to bring the frequency from alpha down to theta.
Yes.
Magic.
A lot went on in ancient times that we're not aware of.
No. But anyway, really what is your main interest has been the remote viewing side of it, which was written up and publicised for a while anyway by the CIA.
Yes, perhaps I could just mention my book. It's called World Religion and History Back to 70,000 BC by Remote Viewing. That's available on my website at a, a cost-only price, a non-profit price, so I don't make any money out of it. I just wanted to publicise this. It's a 400-page hardback. Do look at my website and have a look at what I've put in there.
Yes. I have a copy in my hand. It's an interesting book. So, well, how are we doing for time? Yes, it's gone on a bit. Okay, Gwyn, I'll put some of the information on the description that goes with this program, but if you're able to put some of the links on your website so that people
I'll do
can,
that, yes. Yes. That and if anyone wants to write to me, they've got my email, info@4-d.org.uk. I will try and answer any questions if I can.
Okay.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, and it has been very nice of you to discuss it. Lots of very interesting things, I have to say. Okay. Well, thank you again. We'll have to leave it at that, I'm afraid.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gwyn asked me to give a warning about using the Egyptian spoked wheel to bring on deep trance. He said you must keep your eyes closed, otherwise the sun will damage your eyes. Good advice, I'm sure. Gwyn certainly covered most of the ways that are used to induce an altered state, which are used not only for remote viewing, but for a variety of other supposedly paranormal activities. There are, of course, at least two other ways of bringing on deep trance. One is the use of small pendulum, known as map dowsing, which is just another name for remote viewing, and the other is known as hypnosis, or guided meditation, used to bring on ecstatic enlightenment, to remember past lives, or for remote viewing. In the study of the paranormal, we tend to use the term remote viewing to cover things that are not viewing at all, like physical movements of, say, a compass needle, or altering the weight of a small object. Likewise, the term near-death experience covers some phenomena that are nothing to do with near-death. I think this is rather unfortunate, and it adds to the mystique of the paranormal. For example, some things called remote viewing are only telepathy, where a person draws sketches in one room of pictures being viewed by someone in another room. The sort of thing done as a party game. When it comes to a picture in a sealed envelope, it's infinitely more difficult, especially if no one knows which picture is in the envelope. Surely that must be remote viewing, if there's no chance of normal telepathy. When it comes to professional remote viewing in a show, some resort to using conjuring tricks that are pretty obvious, which is a shame, as it plays into the hands of those critical, sceptical people. What the sceptics don't seem to realise is that they are paranormal themselves, and with some determination and the right training, they could be remote viewers themselves doing simple telepathy. But proper remote viewing is a different matter, which still involves deep trance and that telepathic carrier, which is all important to life, although it is just used in a different way. The power of the mind seems to be able to move the pointer of an instrument needle or a compass needle by means of the quantum carrier, but only with the greatest difficulty. And the carrier seems to work the other way, where the mind can obtain the impression about some distant object. And that's not mind to mind, but mind seeing a remote physical object. So that's remote viewing, very much paranormal, and making use of the normal carrier of telepathy. Also, remote viewing relies on being able to reach that special state of mind needed for any paranormal experience, the state where the mind is empty, but with the gain turned up, as Gwyn said, in which there is a predominance of the theta brain rhythm. This is the state of healing, telepathy, dowsing, or lucid dreaming They're all the same, allowing the unconscious brain to do the work rather than the mind. That doesn't mean that the mind is asleep, it's just that it's not in charge. So now, thanks again to the Professor Gwyn Hocking for telling us so much about remote viewing and the methods of achieving it. I'm Richard Allibone, signing off on webtalkradio.net. Bye for now.